Earlier this month, the president announced plans to cut $1.1 trillion from the deficit over 10 years. Many mayors and other locally elected officials are greatly concerned about one proposal: cuts to the long-standing community development block grant programs. NPR's Alex Kellogg reports that even some Republicans oppose the move.
Roughly 1,200 cities and counties in the U.S. receive community development block grants, also known as CDBGs. They fund everything from affordable housing to job creation programs. The government gave out nearly $4 billion in block grants last year. Most of that money went directly to cities and counties. President Barack Obama is now proposing a cut of roughly $300 million. Oklahoma City Mayor Mick Cornett, a Republican, opposes the cuts.
There's outrage. There's panic. There's the situation that, you know, we've got to stop whatever it is we're doing and be heard on this particular issue at this particular time.
Democrats and Republicans at the local level say such cuts will only hurt cash-strapped communities. But the cuts could go even further if congressional Republicans have their way. Many Republicans are pushing for a cut of roughly $2.5 billion. Cornett is the president of Republican mayors and local officials. His city received $7.1 million in block grant money in the last fiscal year alone. So he was in Washington, D.C. this week to meet with White House officials. At the top of his agenda, pushing back on the proposed cuts. On Thursday, he joined 30 U.S. mayors who urged Congress not to move forward. Cornett admits that on this issue, Republicans at the local and national level don't see eye to eye.
They have heard me year in and year out. This is an annual issue. Throughout the Bush White House years, we were receiving, you know, small cuts in CDBG. And so I know there's not a single representative for the state of Oklahoma who doesn't already know how the mayor of Oklahoma City feels.
Block grants were created by President Gerald Ford in 1974. They were preceded by a more complex, competitive grant process considered far less efficient. Local officials across the country say despite their effectiveness, they're persistently singled out for cutbacks. Ron Loveridge is the mayor of Riverside, California. He says, given the sagging economy, this is the worst possible time to take money away from cash-strapped communities.
At the very time where you need this sort of help, particularly for disadvantaged members of the community, the opposite is taking place.
Last year alone, Riverside used millions in block grant money for park upgrades, housing developments, and street improvements. But congressional Republicans argue the government is out of money and can't keep passing the nation's massive debt on to future generations. House Republican Roscoe Bartlett of Maryland.
We have got to make cuts. This is totally unsustainable, and business as usual is just not an option now.
The National League of Cities doesn't see it that way. Jim Hunt is a council member in the small town of Clarksburg, West Virginia. He's also a past president of the NLC.
The one thing that Republicans and Democrats have generally joined together is to say that CDBG is a worthy program and one that shouldn't be cut.
The group is not giving up. During the congressional recess this week, the NLC urged mayors and other local officials to continue to lobby their lawmakers. Alex Kellogg, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. American car companies are on the rebound, but they're finding it harder to attract young buyers. 20-somethings aren't likely to wait for the latest car magazine, and they're less likely to see the latest TV commercial. NPR's Sonari Glinton reports on how the auto giants are trying to capture a fractured youth market.
Okay, folks, it's time to get into the Wayback Machine. We'll set the dial to 1959. Back here in 1959, if you want to sell a car, you only need a car, in this case, a Chevy Impala, a star, in this case, Dinah Shore, and a catchy tune.
Chevrolet is the one that proves the fun, the fun, the fun is in the going, come rain or shine or snowing.
I mean, who didn't love Dinah Shore? So you'd probably head into the showroom. Once you went with Dinah and Chevy, you stuck with them. These days,
the Dinah Shore approach by itself doesn't work anymore.
John Emmert is the global marketing manager for Ford. He says it's getting tough for car commercials to reach customers, especially young ones, who are more fickle and
the media is getting very fragmented. So in order to reach the people you're trying to reach, you need to have a broad approach, or in terms of the media you consider, and a targeted approach based on, you know, finding where these people are.
Meaning you have to hit all the mediums to find the customers, and you got to do it quick. The Ford Focus has one new ad campaign for the whole world.
It might be hard to believe that the new Focus can actually park itself. Till you actually see it. Park itself. The all-new Focus with class-exclusive Active Park Assist.
Short commercials like that, plus an internet TV show, a social media campaign, a charity reality show, Facebook, and more. All for one car. Jeremy Anwill is CEO of Edmunds.com. He says the big car companies have the kind of money they haven't had in years, and they're spending a lot of it going after young people. They're not always successful.
Right now, the car companies are very focused on, you know, getting people to like their Facebook page, which to me is kind of irrelevant.
Anwill says the key is to find a natural way to surprise people with a car, then get them to talk about it.
That seems pretty simple, but, you know, in the car industry, we just haven't quite figured out how to get to that level of some sort of surprise that triggers these conversations.
Anwill says as the car industry gets more competitive and media more fractured, it'll be harder for any car to be heard. Plus, no one can get Dinah Shore. Sonari Glenton, NPR News, Detroit.
The fun, the fun.
The fun is in the knowing. The fun is in the going.
In the slim line, fresh and fine.
Chevrolet. This is NPR News.
On a snowy February day in 2002, the well-known British journalist Petra Coburn was in Kabul in Afghanistan, covering the fall of the Taliban. That day, he picked up his satellite phone to call his wife Jan. She was back in Canterbury, England. Even over that shaky and hollow telephone line, Jan sounded anxious.
I could not make out the details, but I grasped that Henry, our 20-year-old son, had nearly died when he swam New Haven Estuary, fully clothed, and was rescued by fishermen as he left the near-freezing water. The fishermen feared he might be suffering from hypothermia and took him to a general hospital in Brighton. The police had been called. They had decided that Henry was a danger to himself, and he was now in a mental hospital.
The next morning, Patrick Coburn and his driver braved the treacherous Kabul Gorge. Just a few weeks earlier, four journalists had been killed by Taliban militiamen in that same place. And he went through there and made his way to Islamabad in Pakistan to catch the first flight home. His son Henry was diagnosed with schizophrenia. The story of what happened next, Henry's experiences in and out of mental hospitals for 8 years, and how the family coped is told in a new memoir. It's called Henry's Demons, and in it, Patrick, Henry, and Jan all write alternating chapters, each from a different perspective. Patrick and Henry Coburn join me now from London. Welcome to you both.
Nice to be here.
Hello.
Patrick, let's start at the beginning. You had just seen Henry a few weeks earlier. This was back Christmas of 2001. Were there any signs, any signals that Henry was in trouble?
No, I didn't see any, and I've been back over it in my mind 100 times. I mean, I asked him how he was. He'd started at art college a few weeks earlier, and he said he'd never been happier in his life.
Henry, you that night, you were found by fishermen, as we just heard, in near freezing water in an estuary. What do you remember about that night? I mean, do you remember swimming in that
water?
Yeah,
I felt I was sort of running away and that people... people were following me, and I'm glad I crossed the estuary, because I felt I was following a path, as it, and trying to sort of escape the city and get back to Canterbury.
Canterbury is where you're, of course, where you're from. You were trying to get from Brighton, the town of Brighton, southern England, to the town of Canterbury.
Yeah, it's the most I've ever walked in one day. I walked about 25 miles across the coast. And I walked by the coast, by the sea, and there was this big wall, and I thought that there were prisoners behind the wall. And it was all quite daunting. It was quite scary.
Do you remember why you decided to swim in the water?
I felt a force sort of pulling me in. It was as if I was being beckoned into the water. I mean, I had a choice. I could have stayed out of the water, but I felt beckoned, and I got to the other side, and it was dead cold, and I could... I was quite close to death, I think.
Patrick, you, by the time you arrived, Henry had already been moved to another hospital, a psychiatric hospital. Describe what he looked like when you saw him.
Well, you know, in some ways he looked the same physically, but his whole somehow, everything about him had changed. He seemed sort of frightened by what had happened. He seemed a bit sort of separate from the world.
Henry, what was going through your mind at that time? I mean, what did you think was happening to you?
I felt I was sort of changing my lifestyle. I'd given up marijuana, I'd given up tobacco, I'd given up alcohol. I thought there was something more to the world that I hadn't seen before. You know, I found it revelatory, these experiences, talking to trees and, you know, it was like a hidden world.
I'm speaking with the journalist Patrick Coburn and his son Henry. Their co-memoir is called Henry's Demons, Living with Schizophrenia, a Father and Son's Story. Henry, when you spoke to trees and when you had visions, you described seeing rings like a wedding ring right in front of you and tree roots reaching out to you. I mean, that is very real to you.
It's still real. I'm never going to believe that it wasn't. It was, you know, as real as me talking now.
They weren't hallucinations?
No.
Patrick, when you go overseas now, because you obviously you're a foreign correspondent, you write for The Independent. Mm. Do you have some anxiety about leaving Henry behind?
Yes, about every 5 seconds, yes. You know, I worry about it the whole time. And I try and sort of reduce the worry. But it's difficult. I mean, Henry's, you know, things are going much better now, but it's very difficult to sort of get memories out of your head. I mean, Henry feels, you know, that his life was never... He was never close to death, or he certainly wasn't trying to commit suicide. And I'm sure, you know, he wasn't. But if you, you know, swim in freezing seawater, how long do people normally live there? Now, whatever Henry's intentions, there's no doubt he came close to death again and again. So, you know, I remember that. So I'm anxious, and I'm probably over-anxious, but I don't think it's probably... I suspect it's something that I'll never be able to turn the clock back on for the rest of my life.
And let me ask you, Henry, do you feel like you're cured?
Yeah.
Do you feel like you can have a normal life?
Yeah.
Tell me about your life now. You don't live in a hospital now. You live kind of on your own, right?
Yeah. By next week, I should be sort of... I've got my own apartment now. It's got a front room, a bedroom, a toilet and a kitchen, looks onto the sea. So that's, you know, that's positive.
That's Patrick Coburn and his son Henry. Their co-memoir is called Henry's Demons, Living with Schizophrenia, a Father and Son's Story. Gentlemen, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Now, it's not only Republicans like Scott Walker and Chris Christie who are challenging unions. When it comes to teachers' unions, it's increasingly Democrats, people like Michelle Rhee. She was the head of the Washington, D.C. school district for about 3 years. And during that time, she fired hundreds of teachers who she said were underperforming. And she also tied pay increases to merit, not to tenure. Now, she's heading up an education advocacy group based out of Sacramento. It's called Students First. And with it, she hopes to create a powerful lobby to push for education reform.
Over the last 30 years, the education policy has been driven in this country by lots of special interest groups, including the teachers' union. And I think that one of the missing pieces is that there is no organized national interest group that has the heft that the unions and other groups do who are advocating on behalf of children. So we're going to be doing a few things. One, we're going to be working in a few anchor states where the governor and legislature are interested in adopting all or a significant percentage of our policy agenda. We're also going to be working across the country on certain agenda items as well. So, for example, the first one that we are going to be launching is to try to get rid of LIFO provisions. That's last in, first out. When layoffs are conducted in this country of teachers, they are conducted by seniority, which means that the most junior teachers are let go first.
Even if they're the best.
Even if they're the best. And these, what we call LIFO provisions, make absolutely no sense for children, because the research shows that, number one, you end up firing some of your best teachers. Number two, you have to fire more teachers because the junior teachers get paid the least, so you have to fire more of them to cover the budget deficit. And then three, that it disproportionately negatively impacts the lowest performing schools, the highest need schools, because they have the largest number of new teachers. So the policies are absolutely not good for children. We understand that they may serve some adult interests, but that is a policy that nationwide we are going to have a heavy campaign to try to change. Mm.
Michelle Rhee, I understand that Students First will support the idea of vouchers for students who choose to attend private schools. You have long been an advocate for strong public education. Obviously, that's what you're known for. I wonder if that position is a form of resignation in a way that in your view, elements of public education will not be salvageable.
No, not at all. Hmm. When I was the chancellor of the Washington, D.C. public school system, my purview and my day-to-day was focused on building a great public school system, traditional public school system. And, you know, I'm a Democrat, a lifelong Democrat, so when I was not running the school district, I was not in favor of vouchers. I thought these public money going to private institutions, not a good thing. I changed my mind when I actually came to D.C. because I was faced with a situation where mothers who lived in Anacostia, which was the poorest part of town, would come to me, and they had done everything that you would want a mother to do. So they research their neighborhood school, and they find out that it's failing. Then they apply through the lottery process for one of the few schools that we had in the district that was performing well, and they didn't win a seat in the lottery. And then those mothers would come to me and say, what am I supposed to do now? And if I did not have a place for their children at one of my public schools that I would feel comfortable sending my own children to, then who am I to deny that parent a $7,500 voucher, which, by the way, is $1,500 less than we were spending per child in the public schools, so that they could attend a good, for example, parochial school, Catholic school. My job is to make sure that kids are getting a great education. And if I can't provide that for them today, but they can get it somewhere else, then that's got to be our goal, not preserving the system, but making sure that kids are getting a great education.
Mayor Kevin Johnson in Sacramento boasted that out of all the mayors in the country, he was the one that managed to get you to base your organization in his city. He had a little bit of an advantage.
He had a little bit of an advantage because we are going to get married. but he gave me a really good sell. And Sacramento, under his leadership, is really an up-and-coming city. My staff and I just took a visit out to Sacramento last weekend. I got them excited about moving out there, so we're looking forward to it.
That's Michelle Rhee. She's the former chancellor of the District of Columbia school system and now heads Students First. It's an education advocacy group based out of Sacramento, California. Michelle Rhee, thank you.
Thank you.
For the past 5 weeks, we've been going through thousands of stories you all sent in for this round of 3-Minute Fiction here on Weekends on All Things Considered. The challenge this time was that each story had to have a character who cried and a character who told a joke. Now, we're almost finished reading through all of those stories that came in, and in a few weeks, our judge this round, the novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, will pick a winner. But we've pulled her away to give us an update, and Chimamanda, it's great to have you back.
It's good to be back.
So first of all, I hope you're having fun. I hope this is not a burden to read all these
no,
stories?
No, certainly not.
And how have they been so far?
They've actually been very good. I have been impressed by how they are actually stories. They're not just mere scene settings, because that's what I imagine they might be, because you just have such little space to write a story. But many of these stories are actually stories, and they do emotion and character well, and they are interesting, and they keep me reading, and I've been quite impressed.
So Chimamanda, we asked you to come in, to check in with us, and to read from, you know, a story or two that caught your eye so far. The first one you picked is something that we actually posted on our website a few weeks ago. It's called The Crimson Tree. Can you read a bit of that for us?
I picture Ann Yi, whom I barely knew, with her chicken. I picture her crying, her face in its feathers. She should not have broken the rules, I say automatically. But even as I say the words, I feel a wave of envy. I want a chicken. I want instructions from a ghost. She even named the chicken, says Jing. She called it Peng Yu. Every night she sang it a sweet, sweet song in her dialect. How do you know all this? You're not even in her dormitory. At this, Jing laughs so hard her fingers almost slip, and a girl in the next row glares at her.
That story is The Crimson Tree by Angela Sorby of Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And Chimamanda, that story has gotten some mixed reviews, actually, on the website. If you look at the comments, what was it about the story that drew you to it?
Well, first of all, it was about something.
Right.
Which, you know, which I always appreciate. But also, I love that it was told with a certain restraint, a certain light touch, and that because of that, it avoided sentimentality, because it's really about Chinese workers who are walking in just horrible conditions. And it's not so much about this girl who has killed herself. It's also, in a larger sense, about being in a soul-killing job. Mm. So that these people ostensibly alive really aren't. They're all dead. They're really just sort of, you know, going through the motions, and all humanity has been sort of, you know, removed from them. It's powerful, but it's not too obvious.
Right. You brought another story with you. This one's called Dolls. It's by Ty Nolan of Tempe, Arizona. Can you tell us what the story's about?
What I was drawn to in particular in Dolls was the sense of melancholy and the idea of losing the way things were, and also culture clash. So there's the Native American life, the rural reservation, and then it's contrasted with the city where this character has a life that's very different, and there's a sense of mourning, of a passing, of a way of life that I found very moving.
Can we hear a bit of that story?
Three of our family have marched through death's doorway, two lubed through with alcohol, and one who fell in a manner considerably heavier and more permanently than the rains of my birth month. Capricorn, Virgo, and Aries were removed from the calendar in a way Pope Julian would have admired. I grew up on our reservation, 3 hours away from anything one would recognize as a city, and 5 hours' drive from an airport where anything bigger than a crop duster would take off. At night, the smell of juniper pervades the air. Perhaps the geographic isolation has allowed us to keep our old ways more pristine, but I suspect our attitude is a far better barrier than the simplicity of miles.
That's novelist Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie reading from the original short story Dolls. It's one of her favorites that came in this round of our 3-minute fiction contest so far. And Chimamanda will continue to read your stories until she picks a winner. You can read the full versions of all of Chimamanda's top picks at our website. It's npr.org/3MinuteFiction. 3-Minute Fiction, all spelled out, no spaces. And you can also join the ongoing conversation at our 3-Minute Fiction Facebook page. Chimamanda, thank you so much for checking in with us, and we'll talk in a couple weeks.
Thank you.
It can be very dangerous work for the journalists involved covering the civil unrest in the Middle East. Some reporters in Egypt were detained and even assaulted while reporting on the uprising there. But few places have been as tough to cover as Libya, where the country's authoritarian leader, Muammar Gaddafi, is fiercely clinging to power. NPR's David Folkenflik has been tracking the coverage and is in the NPR bureau in New York. David, what's different here?
Think about Egypt. I mean, for all the dangers that Egypt posed to people trying to cover it there, Western reporters, it's traditionally a country that's been more cosmopolitan, more receptive to the West, and particularly the Western press. It had been an ally of the U.S. Libya, think about that, a rogue regime for a generation. Gaddafi, if anything, more authoritarian than Hosni Mubarak. As the State Department now points out, I've got a statement here, Libyan officials still sympathetic to Gaddafi say they consider reporters who are in the country in an unauthorized way to be terrorists allied with al-Qaeda, and they'll be treated accordingly. As just a hint of how repressive it still is there, protesters have been using coded messages on the Middle Eastern equivalent of Match.com to coordinate actions, according to one story I saw on ABCNews.com. This is a place that is very authoritarian. It has a tradition of it, and Gaddafi is not giving up any of that without a fight.
So where are the journalists reporting from, then?
Well, right now, reporters have been able to get into the eastern part of the country on its eastern border. It's shared with Egypt. Ben Wiederman of CNN getting some very incredible footage from cities there. Our own Lourdes Garcia Navarro, the New York Times, all from Benghazi in the east. Those are, of course, areas that have been held by forces that are antipathetic to Gaddafi, that oppose him quite strongly. In the meantime, Gaddafi officials have seemed to offer to invite some Western reporters there, and it's been a little befuddling to a lot of media executives. It appears as though CBS took advantage of that. One of their reporters arrived in Tripoli, the capital that is still held by Gaddafi. Ben Plesser offered what appears to be the first video by an American TV journalist from Tripoli, but he acknowledged on the air that he was being sort of monitored and corralled by official minders at all time. In the meantime, a lot of news outlets have had to rely on reports from neighboring countries, from Egypt to the east, from Tunisia to the west, even experienced reporters like those for the Los Angeles Times. It's a dangerous place. As the BBC's foreign editor pointed out recently, Libya, if you think about it, is mostly barren desert. It's not an area that's easily to slip into in a clandestine way.
So how are the Western news organizations compensating to fill in the gaps in the knowledge of the story?
Well, they're pulling in from myriad sources. You know, if you saw, for example, Anderson Cooper's show in recent days, where he was interviewing CNN journalists or other sources, and in the background showing videos taken from social media places like YouTube. Cooper all the while indicating, look, these are not videos that we can verify. Here's what we believe them to be showing, or here's what they present themselves as showing. Just a few days ago, our own Michelle Norris interviewed on the air a businessman from a town about 25 miles west of Tripoli. The town's called Zawiya. And he described for her what it was like for him to be in the middle of a square amid protests against the Gaddafi regime. And during the interview, you could hear live rounds of ammunition going off in the background, what perhaps sounded like shelling occurring against actual Libyan citizens. You know, Michelle was getting a firsthand report. She had to acknowledge this was something we couldn't verify on our own. But as long as people were acknowledging what they could and could not confirm on their own, as long as journalists were careful to do that, their ability to obtain some of these firsthand reports were very, very valuable indeed.
NPR's David Folkenflik in our New York bureau. David, thank you.
You bet.